This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A grand jury has issued a mammoth 100-plus count indictment of former Coliseum operators. Close to $1 million was stolen from the city of Bloomington over 7 years.
These are merely accusations, and he is certainly entitled to his day in court.
Defense attorney Stephanie Wong represents one of the defendants. Hear from her and others in the case as GLT's Ryan Denham unpacks the scheme and get reaction from Mayor Pro Tem and Ward 6 Alderman Karen Schmidt. She's in the studio to also talk about sewer rates and the search for the city's next city manager. And the next six-week film school showing at the Normal Theater focuses on the work of Martin Scorsese. Hear from the man behind the Film Fest series. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's September 26th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Coming up, a conversation with GLT's Ryan Denham about some of the details of the indictments released implicating former managers and employees of the Coliseum in an alleged scheme to steal from the city. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. The Bloomington City Council voted to increase sewer rates and chose an option with more upfront funding to address a multi-million dollar backlog in sewer repairs. The council will soon begin discussing the hiring of a new city manager now that David Hales has announced he's accepted a job in Joliet. And we learned about the more than 100 charges in a grand jury indictment of former managers of the city-owned Coliseum. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. And here to talk about all of that is Mayor Pro Tem and Ward 6 Alderman Karen Schmidt, in for Mayor Terry Renner. Karen, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So what's your reaction to the indictment of the former Coliseum managers and employees?
Well, I don't think I can say a whole lot specifically about the case itself. It's in the judicial system, but I feel very confident that we have a far better and more transparent contract with VenueWorks, and I feel that there's been a lot of necessary due diligence done on what has happened in the past. And I think that you'll probably hear a whole lot more from the City of Bloomington about how all of that transpired once we're past the current indictment phase.
Well, given that you may have limited possibilities in what you can say, I have a lot of questions. So we'll just continue.
Okay.
We'll continue to plow forward, and you answer however you think you can. Is there anything you want to say about council or staff oversight of Coliseum management in the last 10 years?
I feel that we had quite a bit of diligence based on the way that the contract was written, and I think that there is a sense that in venues like the Coliseum, there's a lot of proprietary information. And I think we've learned quite a bit from that.
Those contracts don't appear to have provided enough protection to the city, though.
Yes, and I think that you will see, you know, with the VenueWorks or any other contracts that we have, we remedy that when the way that we approach these.
So do you think there's any malpractice on the part of former city manager Tom Hamilton or the city's former attorney Todd Greenberg for not having a more ironclad contract that provided that transparency?
Oh, I would never begin to try to cast any kind of guilt like that. I don't know.
What about Mayor Steve Stockton? Does he bear any responsibility?
No. Mayor Stockton really worked very hard to move the Coliseum into an asset for this community, and I give him a lot of kudos for the work that he did.
So you said as this progresses, maybe as it progresses through the judicial system, or maybe after the judiciary process has concluded, we would know more. What did the city know, and when did it know it? Were there suspicions that led the city to call for increased transparency in the next SIAM contract that was being negotiated in the spring of 2016?
I don't think I am in a position really to know specifically what conversations might have occurred. I do know, though, that our search for a new management company was very intentional and very thoughtful.
Were you on the council when the original SIAM contract was drafted and approved?
I've been on the council since we voted. The council voted on the Coliseum. And you were
a no vote.
I was a no vote. I didn't think it was a good idea at the time, and I have not actually changed my mind about that, but we have it now, so, you know, let's make the best of it.
So do you recall what kind of thought was given to the reporting requirements back then, you know, in terms of what SIAM should release or should be transparent about?
I think we worked on a contract in a area where maybe we didn't necessarily have all of the knowledge and skill set that we might have had. And, you know, hindsight is 20/20.
Sure.
You know, we could have easily maybe gone out and found some legal advice from a company that does these kinds of contracts all the time. We didn't do that.
Was there concern about a 10-year contract, the length of that contract? The contract with VenueWorks, I believe, is 5 years.
I honestly don't remember those kinds of details. I'm sure 10 years feels like a very long time to me, regardless.
So do you think current or past aldermen bear any responsibility in this situation? I mean, are you thinking about that kind of thing at all?
I think that I need to know a whole lot more about the sort of in a longitudinal way about how all of this unfolded. And I know that I don't have all the facts. So I think it's unfair for me to speculate.
So no one has been convicted, but prosecutors allege the city may have been scammed. What kind of protections do you think should have been in place to prevent this? Or what kind of after-the-fact audits should have occurred to discover the problem that eventually led to these indictments?
Hindsight 2020, I wish that we'd had a contract for that the way that we have with VenueWorks, where there is a lot of transparency and partnership.
And are there concerns, do you have concerns that this kind of episode will embolden those critics of city government who see malfeasance lurking behind every corner, even when it's not there? You hear from a lot of these people at every council meeting.
Yes, but I would counter that by saying that we now have a really large indictment against five people. We uncovered the problem, we addressed the problem, and we've set in place a contract with a new company that gives us a whole lot more control and partnership over that particular entity.
And these people might say, that's great, but that's too little too late. We've been saying there were problems there for years.
A lot of the people, I think, who are bitter about the Coliseum have always been bitter about the Coliseum, and I understand that.
Are there similar contracts or situations in terms of city-contracted services which should be re-examined at this point?
I can't think of any, no. It's an unusual, the Coliseum itself is a sort of unusual area for the city to get into, in my opinion, and I think it, you know, kind of stands alone that way.
So what are you hearing from your constituents about this situation?
I haven't heard a lot, actually. We heard quite a bit last night at the council meeting. You know, this just came out, and people were very disappointed and, you know, feel that we, you know, that just disappointed that it happened. And I certainly think that they were talking to nine people who felt the same. However, you know, I do feel that we've done what we need to do to correct that. And so I haven't heard a lot negative, not at this point.
Sure.
But you know, it's 24 hours later, so.
How do you think voters may react to this news in terms of, because you're an elected official, mm-hmm. others on that council were elected by their ward constituents. Mm-hmm. How do you think this will play out in terms of future elections?
I don't know. I think that there's still a lot of facts that need to come out, and hopefully people will vote knowing what the facts are.
It's Sound Ideas, coming up more on the Coliseum charges with digital content director Ryan Denham, who is following the story. I'm Mike McCurdy in the studio with Bloomington Mayor Pro Tem and Ward 6 Alderman Karen Schmidt. Let's talk sewer rates, a big hike in bills. Council ultimately approved the more aggressive option, getting more money up front in fees and the ability to start work on sewers sooner. Why the 5-4 vote?
I I would say, first of all, that there, I think that there were, the entire council understands how critical this work is, and to do the sewers, sanitary sewer and stormwater, and to build our roads based on you know, what's underneath as well, and correct it all at once. However, going to a $6 and 6 cent hike immediately was a really pretty big bite for to take on. I can certainly speak for myself in saying that I voted against it because I have a number of concerns about the way that we have a tendency to vote in one fee or one fee increase, rate increase at a time without looking holistically at the budget. So we've done this now, and we're about to enter a 5-6 month period, well, 4 or 5 month period, where we're looking at the budget as a whole, knowing that we have many other needs for capital improvements, and that we can't make that money by continually just asking for increases in rates and fees. We have a structural deficit, and I think we need to look at the whole budget. I heard other aldermen express concern about this being $6. You know, maybe we do $2 over 3 years and ease into it. I heard other aldermen suggest that it somehow be rated according to maybe the value of a property, so it's not equal overall. And I'm not sure, actually, as an enterprise fund, that's something that we're able to do. But there was still a lot of concern about it being $6. And, you know, I know in my ward, in my neighborhood, and with tenants that we have, you know, sometimes it's hard to pay your electric bill, let alone add another $6 a month onto a water bill. So
At the same time, your ward also has some of the most critical sewer needs. It's one of the older wards. Some of these problems are decades in the making.
Yes,
how would you characterize the state of the city's sanitary sewers?
Well, speaking from experience, our house actually we discovered had a wildcat sewer, so we don't really
wasn't even really documented or mapped.
So this year the city in that particular part of Dimmitt's Grove, actually, we got a sewer, and we didn't get our sewer replaced. We got a sewer. So that's kind of hard to get your head around. You know, and so yes, there are many, many great needs here. I just think that for me, I want to see that balanced against a bigger conversation about our budget.
Do you anticipate the 3% annual increase in fees to sunset at some point, or is that necessary to continue to maintain this infrastructure in light of the $6 jump?
We don't know that yet, and that was something that a couple of aldermen asked to have built in, and that was an amendment that was defeated. I hope that we'll continue to look at that as we do at all of our rate structures. And
the 3% did not move forward, or
it's still in there.
It's still in there.
So there's
no sunset.
Right.
That amendment was defeated.
The one concept I think that I found really heartening was a conversation that we had regarding whether or not any of this money was going to go towards adding 9.75 FTE staff to the city payroll. And what came out of that was a lot of interest, I think, in a policy that David Hales has suggested that has all new city hires viewed through a lens of whether it should be an in-house position or one that is contracted out. Obviously, police and fire would be exempted from that, but, you know, looking at support staff and, you know, all kinds of technical work. We need the work done, but once it's done, we now have, you know, a long-term pension obligation. So I think that this is a way for us to get our hands around, philosophically around, you know, how does our budget grow?
So it's not that the staff isn't needed. It's not that there's not work to do.
Correct.
It's whether or not they should be city employees and whether or not the city should take on that future obligation.
Right. I think one of the aldermen put it really well in saying that once this work is done, you know, suppose we get over the large hump of this work in 6 to 10 years, we still have those people possibly for another 30 years.
infrastructure, especially roads, seem to be a priority for citizens.
Yes.
Are you hearing pushback from citizens in your ward on this sewer increase?
Oh, yes.
Or thanks for addressing the issue and working to fix the problems, including resurfacing roads, which can't happen until the sewers underneath are sound.
Right. In my ward, I haven't had anybody say thank you. And that doesn't mean that they're not grateful, but I started receiving phone calls a couple of days ago, and I've had plenty of emails this morning from people saying how disappointed they were that it was a $6 increase.
It's Sound Ideas. Mayor Pro Tem Karen Schmidt is setting in for Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Is it time for a new city manager in Bloomington, or would you have liked to have continued with City Manager Hales, who has announced he's leaving for Joliet?
I would have been delighted if David had stayed. I enjoy working with David. I think he's a very talented man. He has really put in place a lot of good policies for this city. And he has, you know, I don't know why somebody wants to be a city manager. Honestly, you know, they put out, you know, they set forth a number of recommendations for things to do, you know, that we ought to be doing. The council can accept them or ignore them. And at the end of the day, a lot of times it's still the city manager's fault, even though he or she isn't making that decision.
So would you have voted for a contract extension had one come up?
Yes, absolutely.
When will council begin discussing the process for hiring a new city manager?
Well, I think we'll, you know, obviously Mayor Renner will be back next week, and we'll start those conversations once he's back at City Hall. And we'll also at the same time talk about appointing an interim city manager.
Yeah. And who might that be?
I don't think we know, but I do feel like we have a lot of options available to us. David's hired very well. He's got a very strong staff, and I think we have options there. I would imagine we'd also examine whether or not we wanted somebody from the outside, as we did between our two police chiefs. My inclination, I think, from what I hear other aldermen say, is that we'll, you know, likely look within.
You've been through this how many times before as alderman?
Just once.
Just once. Mm-hmm. What sort of process would you like to see?
Well, the one that we used last time I thought worked really well. We did hire a firm to help us with the search. And I know people ask, why do you do that? You know, just y'all got common sense. Just put that ad out there and interview people. But I know myself that, you know, I'm in my career, I've had headhunters come after me for jobs that maybe I would have never thought about taking. You know, and they'd say, look, we've matched you up. You know, here's why this would be attractive. So I think that there's a real value to that, as well as really digging down into the strengths and challenges that different applicants may bring to a position.
So David Hales is moving on. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose the qualities and vision that David Hales had. What sort of qualities and experience would you like in the next city manager? Would they be duplicative of David Hales, or do you think there's an opportunity here to find something different or in addition to what David can bring to the city?
Well, I certainly think we want to continue the good financial oversight and knowledge that David brought with him. That's very important. David is a very ethical man, and I value that a great deal. And that's one of those kind of mushy, undefined things. How do you know if somebody is ethical? You know, that's something that probably comes with some due diligence about individuals. Obviously, like to see somebody who's got a lot of vision for all that Bloomington can be, and a strong willingness to collaborate with the town of Normal and the county to grow what is just an amazing place to live. We have a lot to offer, and I want to see us continue to work on that.
Okay. Karen, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas,
as always.
And thanks for setting in for Mayor Terry Renner, who we understand will be back in October. So we will
October the 10th. He's all yours.
All right. Karen, thanks a lot.
The
mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Let's continue our conversation about city government with GLT's Ryan Denham, who spent much of his Monday reviewing and covering the indictment against five former Coliseum managers and employees, a total of 111 counts. Ryan, thanks for stopping by to help unpack the case and to talk about what it means for the city.
Sure thing.
What are these five people actually accused of doing?
So they're accused of participating in a multi-year scheme to skim off concessions money that was owed to the city of Bloomington, divert other money from utilities to personal accounts, and even overbilling and double billing for cleaning supplies and equipment, for example. They're also accused of some tax fraud and money laundering kind of related to all that. We knew this investigation was underway. It came out last year that state police were looking into the mismanagement at the Coliseum. It's still surprising to see the scope of the alleged scheme, that five different people were involved and several different sides of the Coliseum's management.
Some of these names are familiar. Who are they?
So the number one target of prosecutors, it appears to be, is John Butler. He was the owner of Central Illinois Arena Management, which is the management company running the Coliseum for really the first decade of its existence. He faces 44 counts just on his own. Behind him is Jay Lash, who is director of finance for BMI Concessions, which is kind of like an in-house food and beverage company for the Coliseum. He's up against 36 counts in the indictments. Bart Rogers, who was John Butler's kind of second in command, was the Coliseum's general manager, was also charged, as was Kelly Klein, the assistant general manager for the building in charge of finance, and then Paul Grazier, the general manager for that food and beverage side, BMI Concessions.
So I assume they all have lawyers. What are they saying? What are the attorneys saying?
Sure. So we heard back yesterday from the attorneys for John Butler and Bart Rogers. Steve Beckett is the name of the attorney for John Butler. He says that Butler will plead not guilty to all charges, and the Butler is presumed innocent. He said that Butler cooperated with investigation and surrendered to police yesterday on his own volition. Stephanie Wong, who's a notable Bloomington attorney here, represents Bart Rogers, who is the general manager for the building. She said she didn't have a lot of information yet because those indictments were just unsealed yesterday. But she said they were merely accusations and that Bart Rogers was entitled to his day in court.
Based on my review of the charges, it appears that he is clearly not the principal or the principal individual involved, and if, and that's a big if, he was involved at all, that it would be minimum at best, given the seriousness of the other charges against the other co-defendants.
That's Stephanie Wong, the attorney for Bart Rogers. Did Rogers or other people that were indicted appear in court yesterday?
It was sort of an interesting day. The indictments were actually handed down last week, and that's when arrest warrants were issued. The defendants knew they were under investigation, at least some of them did. We were aware of at least the broad strokes of the investigation. I'm told by state police that the suspects surrendered to state police personnel at predetermined locations yesterday. A couple of them appeared in court yesterday. Three of them did not, though. So John Butler was one of the ones who did not. He basically bonded out in time to not have to pop up in court. They all have bonded out by now. John Butler had the highest bond amount, $300,000, which means he had to post $30,000 to get released. They all had mugshots taken, which you can see now at our website, WGLT.org.
Does anyone ever look good in a mugshot?
No, it's not.
The lighting's horrible. So John Butler, who is he? Let's talk about his history in the community.
Sure, yeah. He's been around a while. He's a longtime McLean County resident. His company, Central Illinois Arena Management, was running the Coliseum, again, for that first decade of his existence, starting back in 2006. John Butler is actually now helping run some minor league hockey teams. He's a minority owner of the Peoria Rivermen, which plays in the SPHL, along with Bart Rogers, who's also a minority co-owner. The majority owner of that team, by the way, is also the owner of the Bloomington Thunder, the junior team that plays here in town. So John Butler's 10-year contract with the city ended last spring. They basically walked away from each other. The city's contract with John Butler's company was paying Butler's company between $200,000 and $300,000 each year. That's commissions and sponsorship sales and suites, annual fee, all that. So quite a bit of money going in his direction.
So, Ryan, what does the city have to say about these allegations? We just heard from Karen Schmidt.
So obviously, it has to be an embarrassing day for city officials. City Manager David Hales, who's on his way out, he just accepted a new job in Joliet. He was quoted as recently as September 2015 in a press release about Coliseum financials, saying that the city is fortunate to have a group of very dedicated and talented individuals under the direction of John Butler and Bart Rogers managing the Coliseum. David Hales, Mayor Pro Tem Karen Schmidt, who you just heard from, and Corporation Counsel Jeff Juergens, so basically the city's top attorney, they together issued a statement yesterday. Hales, in that statement, said this has been a long and thorough investigation and that he appreciates the patience of the public during that process. The city's lawyer, Jeff Juergens, had maybe the most substantive comments. He said that the city was targeted by a deeply complex and ongoing criminal scheme, and he specified that no city employee or official is alleged to be involved in any of the charges that were filed. So obviously, Mayor Terry Renner is still on his temporary leave of absence, so we haven't heard from him. Karen Schmidt, in her statement yesterday and again on the air today, said that we have and will always be committed to seeing crimes committed against the city uncovered and prosecuted. Still, it raises that obvious question of who is in charge and who is ultimately responsible. It's an uncomfortable position to blame the victim in any criminal case, right? But it still begs that question. Last night at the Bloomington City Council meeting, Alderman really didn't talk about it during the meeting itself. Afterwards, our reporter, Bailey Steelman, talked to Jamie Matthey, who was a lone alderman who stuck around and talked to reporters. He said that the contract between the council and Central Illinois Arena Management kept the city out of the loop. Matthey says that the new contract with the new managers, Venue Works, requires more transparency.
They know exactly what's going on, where the money's going, what's being used for, where revenues are collected. There was a problem that got fixed in terms of the contracts, and now we legally were not allowed to see some things until the changeover happened.
So this is an understatement. The Coliseum has had critics for a long time. How does that play into this storyline of the city and this arena?
Well, it certainly adds fuel to that fire, right? There are some parts of the community that will never embrace the Coliseum, thinks it shouldn't exist in the first place, that it should be closed down. Others think it's like more like a park and it should be subsidized by the city. It adds millions in economic development benefits to the city each year. Now, though, we have new insight, allegedly, into why the venue was losing so much money year after year. For the past 5 years, it posted a net operating loss. Or at least we know more about why the city wasn't making more from the Coliseum. I spent this morning kind of reviewing the audits and financial reports for the Coliseum. And I know the audits from a company called Sikich didn't really turn up any red flags, but they did say that they did not find any deficiencies in internal control that we considered to be material weaknesses. And that's in 2015. That's pretty recent. So obviously there were some weaknesses in internal control, right? And more than one thing can be true. Just because someone was allegedly stealing money from the Coliseum, it doesn't mean it'll break even now, right? The forces at work in that industry, the concert business and attendance issues at events, those can still be true too. It's not going to just make the Coliseum magically financially solvent again. We'll have to kind of see how Venue Works does in the years ahead.
How did these allegations come to light?
I asked State's Attorney Jason Chambers about that, and his office is the one that's prosecuting the cases. And when he says SIAM here in this audio bite we're going to play, that's Central Illinois Arena Management, Butler's company.
After SIAM left, the management company that came in immediately after SIAM noticed some discrepancies, which they pointed out to the city of what they thought were discrepancies, which they pointed out to the city of Bloomington, which forwarded it to the state police.
And from there, there was a 16-month state police investigation. They got some help from the Illinois Department of Revenue because of that alleged tax fraud. Here's Chambers again talking about the scope of the investigation.
It's a very extensive investigation that state police and some of the state IRS investigators were involved in. It took well over a year, thousands and thousands of pages of documents for them to go through. There's no way to do that thoroughly in a quick manner.
Ryan, I have to wonder if SIAM was between a rock and a hard place in the spring of 2016 when the city tried to renegotiate their contract and put more transparency into that contract. They had to think that if these allegations are true, they were going to be found out if the city moved forward with this contract. And yet they knew if they didn't move forward, the next company might find out. It's an interesting situation that I think bears some thought. Some possible sentences for these people if they are convicted?
Yeah, so four of the five defendants face Class X felonies, which, if they're convicted, would carry a mandatory prison sentence. That's 6 to 30 years in prison on each count. Keep in mind, though, they are innocent until proven guilty. But
John Butler faces 44 counts. Not all of those are Class X felonies.
Correct, yes. So we'll kind of see how the case unfolds. If anyone pleads out or if charges are dropped against certain defendants, we'll just kind of have to let it play out.
So VenueWorks is now managing the arena. New name, new managers. We know that a previous manager under VenueWorks ran into some difficulty. Is the big problem solved with the Coliseum, do you think?
Well, I think what you just mentioned there in terms of the first manager that VenueWorks brought in was ultimately arrested himself and charged with theft. I think he was accused of misusing a credit card for some personal charges, including airline tickets.
Not quite the scheme that Siam is alleged to have participated in.
Not in scope, no. And he's due back in court in October on those charges. That's still kind of an open case, too. Different manager in place now, obviously a new executive director. Things seem to be running a little bit smoother over there, it would appear. But again, we'll just kind of have to let it play out. It's a 5-year contract that VenueWorks has.
GLT Digital Content Director Ryan Denham, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas to talk to us about the Coliseum investigation.
Sure thing.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, reminding families that September is Life Insurance Awareness Month. You can take simple steps today to protect what matters most, from your family to your business. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Hi, I'm Katie Gallagher, and I started giving because I believe a country's growth starts at the community level. GLT is a local news station that helps our community grow by giving its listeners access to coverage of thoughtful and insightful news through a variety of programs. I always come to GLT to get my news, knowing I will hear coverage of today's major political and social issues. I also enjoy ending my day with GLT's jazz, blues, and acousticity programs. Does this sound like you? Then join me in making a first-time contribution now by clicking donate at WGLT.org.
It's easy to set up your $5 or $10 a month contribution, and it makes a big difference for your public radio station. Do it now at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The film director who brought audiences some of the best gangster films ever is featured at the Normal Theater during the next six-week film school. It's called From Alice to Silence, the Scorsese Style. The collection of Martin Scorsese films is curated by ISU English professor and Sound Ideas culture commentator Bill McBride. He also organized so-called film schools on Hitchcock in February and film noir movies featuring femme fatales last year. The six-week film school begins tomorrow with Scorsese's 1974 film, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. McBride says the fest is more film than film school.
Yeah, so we did film noir and we did Hitchcock. Well, the mayor, generous grant, it's free to and open to the public, and we get a pretty good house each night of the 6 weeks. It's a film school in the sense that I do a brief introduction, we show the film, folks are allowed to leave, and then when everyone's gone who wants to go, although not many leave, I say a few things, and then I open it up to questions.
And any progression or connection in mind between the first film festival about femme fatales, the second one on Hitchcock, and then the Scorsese film school?
I think so. I mean, those film noirs are pretty much from the 40s and 50s. Hitchcock, you know, went into later. We're progressing. Scorsese now, here he is. He's still making films. He's working on a couple right now.
Why Scorsese?
So he's the first of the directors. I want to do some other ones, dedicate the festival to other ones. He's the first one to attend film school. Famously, Orson Welles watched Stagecoach 40 times before he made Citizen Kane. Incidentally, Citizen Kane is one of the three of the holy trinity of films that Martin Scorsese bows down to, if you will. It's Citizen Kane, The Red Shoes, and The Leopard, a Visconti film. And Adam Fox over at the Normal is probably going to also screen Red Shoes, and he's looking to get The Leopard, and that would be wonderful.
So why this collection of films? How did it come together?
Well, you'll notice in the list, there are no mafia films, although Marty is known for those, particularly Goodfellas.
Well, that's my next question. So let me get to that first, and we'll come back why you chose these films. Why no gangster films? The Departed won Best Picture, for an Oscar for Best Picture.
It did, and it's got Jack Nicholson. I mean, that was a tough one not to include. I think that the six I chose, have the most style, what I like to call stylized moments, and it's in the title of each of the film festivals so far, and it's in this title as well, where he does things with camera, with lighting, with editing, that communicates meaning. And so these six made the grade.
And the gangster films didn't have that style?
Well, there's a terrific long take in Goodfellas that some of my friends and colleagues have nudged me asking.
Me included.
Yes. Well, I consider you a friend. And there's some interesting things in The Departed that could have made the grade as well. I don't know. Maybe it's my going against the grain. Mm-hmm. I have that.
Let's talk about the 1974 film, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. That opens the film festival on September 27th. What do we learn about filmmaking and Scorsese from this film?
That's a terrific question. HBO picked this movie up maybe a year after its release, right when HBO started. And I was staying in an apartment in Manhattan that had HBO, and I was unemployed. And they played the movie over and over again. So I got to see it in a pre-VCR kind of way and studied it. There's just terrific performances here. I love the script. I'm not talking too much about the style. There will be a nice lap dissolve when we see the two waitresses sunning themselves. And then Scorsese lap dissolves to a camera much, much further away. And it's breathtaking.
And a lap dissolve is?
A lap dissolve is moving from one image to the other. They do it in the lab. They do it in the cutting room. You
just fade out and fade in.
You fade one out and you bring the other one in, yes. And so, it usually means that time has elapsed.
What does it say early on about this director? That he's versatile? That he can do anything? I mean, it is sort of uncharacteristic from what we know about Scorsese later in his career.
Yes. He gets just the best performances out of Ellen Burstyn, and that singer, that Kris Kristofferson, carries the role terrifically. He later on is going to be acting with Barbra Streisand and so on. But this is the beginning of his acting career, and Scorsese, I mean, to have cast him first off, I thought was a brilliant gesture, and what he gets from him is equally great.
Well, we have a singer in The Last Temptation of Christ too, so we'll get to that in a minute. I want to talk about Taxi Driver. It's the only Scorsese film in your 6-week film school featuring Robert De Niro. It's not certainly the only time the two have worked together.
No.
Is this film on the list because of the politics in such a politically charged time? What do you make about its connection to the attempt on President Reagan's life?
Well, I mean, the imbecile who tried to kill Reagan watched Taxi Driver over and over and over
again. As many times as you watched Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
or Orson Welles watched Stagecoach, yes. I don't know what all those connections are. But and he tried to kill Reagan in order to get Jodie Foster's attention.
Who was also in the film.
Who was in the film.
Plays a 12-year-old, her name's Isis, or Iris.
Iris, and she's named that on purpose because of the eye, and we don't know she's a girl until later in the film, and it's this film, brilliantly written, terrifically directed. There's a spectacular jump cut in the middle of the film when Travis Bickle, De Niro, is staring at the mirror, and he's impersonating sticking someone up and shooting someone. And Marty just cuts it and does a retake, and it explodes the film. It reminds you you're watching a film and all of those things that jump cuts do.
And what about the politics? Chosen for the movie's style or the politics that is in this film?
I'm going to go style first, although don't get me wrong. I'm a political animal, as most of us are, and this film speaks volumes. Not only because it's based on a real-life event of an assassination of, I think it was George Wallace, Bremer. And then it's taken up and put on the screen as a fictional account, and then it goes back into real life. So it's art and life interpenetrating each other, and that's fascinating.
Yeah, the pitch on this film in Hollywood must have been fascinating because it is a film that's hard to describe.
Yes.
You mentioned the Are You Looking At Me scene where he's looking in the mirror.
Yes, yes.
I think this is a more powerful monologue, and it gets at De Niro's character. Let's listen to this, and then let's talk about it afterwards.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 in the afternoon to 6 in the morning, sometimes even 8 in the morning, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in 350 a week, sometimes even more when I do it off the meter. Skunk buggers, queens, fairies, dopers, junkies, sick, venal. Someday a real rain will come and wash all this scum off the streets.
It's Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle, a real people person, eh?
Oh, boy.
It makes you wonder if there are some real Travis Bickles out there. What about the look, the feel, the music, and the acting in Taxi Driver? How's it all come together for you?
Let's start with Bernard Herrmann's, the great Hitchcock composer, right? And Marty gets him, and I know that was a coup, and he was jumping up and down. That's a film noir, in a way. That voiceover, that's characteristic of film noir.
That scene is actually at night, most of it.
Yes, and... you know, all the buggers come out at night is a line, another way of saying it in the film. The script is just brilliant. And that's we're alone with this guy. Usually we're alone with Humphrey Bogart or the detective who is telling us the story. But it's told from this guy's perspective, and that gets under your skin in an odd way as well.
And the shots of the taxi... Yeah. Make the taxi a character.
It does. Yes, there are these disembodied as camera just, you know, gives you side shots and low angle shots of the cab. Yeah.
A film set in New York City, another film set in New York City, but in New York City of 1863. And it is a gangster film, but not a mafia film.
Yes.
Gangs of New York showing on October 25th. I can't put my finger on it, but I don't really care for this film. Do you like it?
I love this film.
Why do you like it?
Well, that's a good question. First off, again, I seem to be actor friendly here, but that performance of Butcher Bill is just brilliant.
By Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis, the great Irish actor who... He'll make a film, and then he says, I'm quitting. I'm not making another film. And then 5 years later, he comes back.
He's done that again recently.
Yes.
And any connection between the 1912 film Musketeers of Pig Alley and Scorsese's Gangs of New York? That was in some notes you sent me.
Yeah, allegedly, Marty studied that film quite a bit, an early, early film, and tried to apply some of the things he learned.
That's ISU English professor Bill McBride and Sound Ideas culture commentator and the man behind the 6-week film schools at the Normal Theater. Previous film fests have been on film noir and femme fatales and Alfred Hitchcock. This time it's films directed by Martin Scorsese. Last Temptation of Christ was on Scorsese's list to make for more than a decade before he was able to get to it. Why?
Well, I don't know. I mean, he's a busy fella, and this is a very personal film for Marty. As I mentioned to you, before we went on the air, he and I have connections, both raised in New York, both raised Catholic, both raised altar boys. There's something about being up on the stage, if you will, of the altar. You really get an early sense for theater and for power, the power that the priest has, the power that the director has. In third grade, about on our back wall, we painted ourselves. What would we be when we grew up? I was going to be a priest until somebody explained celibacy to me, and then that went by the wayside. But there is a way in which I'm a priest and in front of the classroom, and I'm preaching the texts I've chosen and the films I've chosen. And that power dynamic, I think, Marty also appreciated.
This movie is based on a controversial 1955 book. The movie was just as controversial in 88. Why?
Yeah, Kazan Zakas's novel, which is a great read. I recommend it. I've got some students reading it. Well, you have Jesus comes down off the cross. And it says last temptation, but we don't really know that. He just comes down and gets married and has a family. And you can imagine the church and those who would want an Orthodox New Testament reading of Jesus would not appreciate that.
Let's listen to another scene from one of these films. This is David Bowie as Pontius Pilate and Willem Dafoe as Jesus.
Tell me what you tell people on the streets.
Yes.
Yes.
The prophet Daniel had a vision. A tall statue had a gold head and silver shoulders. The stomach was bronze, the legs were iron, the feet were clay. A stone was thrown. The clay feet broke and the statue collapsed.
Yes?
You see, God threw the stone. The stone's me in Rome.
Rome is the statue.
Yes.
So your kingdom, or your world, will replace Rome. Where is it?
My kingdom. It's not here. Not on Earth.
Wouldn't be, would it? You know, it's one thing to want to change the way that people live, but you want to change how they think, how they feel.
All I'm saying is that change will happen with love, not with killing.
Either way, it's dangerous. It's against Rome. It's against the way the world is. And killing or loving, it's all the same. It simply doesn't matter how you want to change things. We don't want them changed.
Willem Dafoe and David Bowie in The Last Temptation of Christ, showing on October 11th as part of the six-week film festival at the Normal Theater, featuring Martin Scorsese films. Bill McBride's in the studio. He's the man behind the six-week film schools. What do you think of the casting in this movie?
Well, I love the casting, and it's typical Hollywood, although Marty isn't typical Hollywood. Here we have Jesus, played by Willem Dafoe.
Blue-eyed.
And an American. Notice Pontius Pilate has a British accent. If you look at American films, evil folks, we just did Maltese Falcon in one of my classes. And, of course, Humphrey Bogart, he's got that good Brooklyn American accent. But Sidney Greenstreet is evil and from England. This is classic casting, Hollywood casting.
Movie critic Gene Siskel said the effect of this film on him was to make the message of Jesus more accessible. If he had doubts and fears, then we can be more comfortable with our own. If Jesus can resist temptation, then maybe we can too. What do you think of that assessment?
I love that. And, you know, imitation of Christ, it's easier perhaps to do so if you think Jesus has some human qualities. This is, again, Paul Schrader's screenplay. Like he did with Taxi Driver is brilliant.
And maybe some unattributed rewrites from Scorsese himself on this script as well.
That's right. And Peter Gabriel, also nominated for an Academy Award for his score, which is luscious.
Hugo is the only animated film directed by Martin Scorsese. It shows on November 1st. Why this anomaly, or is it an anomaly?
Well, it's certainly an anomaly in that it's not live action. It's an anomaly that it's allegedly a children's film. To be quite honest, it's a film my 10-year-old daughter can come to on a Wednesday night, and she can see her daddy up there in front of the screen. So it's an amusing film. I love it, and it's for all ages.
How many G or PG movies has Scorsese made? Not many.
Not many, no.
Silence is his latest, and it's unfair to judge any film by its box office, but this made back less than half of its $50 million budget. What do you think of this film?
I love this film. I love the novel.
And briefly, it's about two missionaries go to Japan to try to find their colleague.
Yes. To try to find Liam Neeson. Yeah. Well, it's a religious film in its own way. Marty, as we've said, is a not practicing but a born and raised Catholic. And you know, as the Jesuits say, if they get you before you're 5 years old, they've got you forever.
What do you want to say about this collection of films as a group? These six films.
The festival has now graduated to living directors and directors who have been to film school. And I think that that is a benefit and will pay off. Not that the Hitchcock films or the film noirs were lacking in style or any of that. It's just more of a conversation with a modern day director. And I hope to do some more. I'm not going to mention who or that may be, but I'm looking forward to showing these films coming from someone alive and working amongst us.
What is the one or two overriding stylistic things that maybe connect these films? Something that you would look at and go, oh, that's Scorsese.
You know, I might have been able to answer this before we started talking because because as I've been talking, it seems to me I'm talking more about the performances.
And what about the films not on the list? Raging Bull, one of the top 100 of the last century, Goodfellas, the remake of Cape Fear, all of those happen to have De Niro in them. Maybe the next film festival is a De Niro film fest.
Look at that. And maybe we could get Bobby here, you know?
Might be a long shot.
Yeah, just like Marty.
Bill, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas and to talk about these Scorsese films.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Bill McBride is organizing From Alice to Silence, the Scorsese style at the Normal Theater. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore shows tomorrow at the Normal Theater at 7 p.m. Find the full schedule at WGLT.org. You can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews at WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Share your thoughts by posting comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media at 89.1 FM and WGLT.org.